KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Art heist that they say is the largest seen in years in the Netherlands. They say thieves broke into the Rotterdam Museum today and stole Picasso, Monet, Matisse, and Gauguin paintings worth hundreds of millions of euros. The collection was exhibited to help celebrate the museum's 20th anniversary. News that Scotland will hold a referendum on independence from Britain has grabbed big headlines in Spain. Lauren Frere reports that Spain's richest region, Catalonia, wants to do the same, but faces resistance from Madrid.
Catalonia's president, Artur Mas, says he'll hold a referendum on independence from Spain within 4 years if he wins re-election as expected next month. He says Catalans should be allowed to vote on whether to stay part of Spain or secede and become an independent country. Madrid does not agree. The Spanish Justice Minister says such a referendum would be a crime of disobedience for which the Catalan president could be punished with up to a year in prison. Spain's economic crisis with austerity imposed by Madrid has many Catalans thinking they'd be better off independent. But Spain's constitution doesn't say what happens if one region wants to break away. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Bilbao, Spain.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org.
This word embodies a very specific idea about the obligations we owe to each other when we're dealing with each other in everyday life.
I was paying, no lie, between $400 and $450 a month on gasoline, and I just said, you know what, enough is enough.
He was subjected to heinous abuse, to include 183 sessions of the water board. What that means is that he was brought to the brink of death 183 times by our government.
The Guantanamo trial's getting underway again today. We're going to talk to a reporter on the scene. Also, we're going to hear from Jeffrey Nunberg about the ascent of the A word. But we start with a new electric car that's on the road, the Coda. It's built by an American car company in California from Chinese components. It has a 100-mile range, costs about $38,000 with the federal rebate. The Coda has fewer new electric car amenities. It has a keyed switch, for example, not a push button. No mobile apps, no cruise control, but a pretty nice display. A New York Times reviewer said it connected to his iPod easily. The Coda has a 31-kilowatt-hour battery and charges on a 240-volt plug. Kevin Bose drives a 2012 Coda sedan, the first in Washington State, production number 0024.
My name is Kevin Bose, and we are driving a 2012 Coda sedan.
Now, Coda is not a name that people are going to be familiar with. What is Coda?
Coda is a car company that's based out of Los Angeles. The cars themselves are assembled out of Oakland, California, and they are an electric car company that makes nothing but electric cars. This car is number 24 off the line.
Really? You have the 24th Coda off the line?
Right. Oh, look there, at that. Above the dial indicator, it shows you that it's number 24.
What is this car?
The motor's got 134 horsepower. The motor itself comes from Colorado, as do most of the electric components in it. It's got an advertised range of 125 miles. It's got a top speed of 85 miles an hour. And it seats five, and it's a four-door sedan.
And what does a Coda cost?
I paid $38,000 for this.
And is that about standard, or is that deluxe model, or do you know?
They offered me leather, and I said, no, thank you. And they offered me fancier wheels, and I said, I like the wheels on it just fine. So everything you see here is factory standard.
And like many of a modern car, it's got a visual display. In this case, I'm looking at the GPS now, but I imagine it also shows you how much power you're using, etc.
Yes, if I access the battery status, that's the phone. If I access the battery status, it'll show me how much I've got left on the battery, my minimum expected range, my maximum range, how the motor, climate control, etc., are all doing.
This is very simple. I like how easy this display is to read, don't you?
Yes, it's very intuitive. I don't like to have to figure things out when I'm driving a car. Everything on this vehicle is very easy. It's as much like driving a gasoline car in that The ignition starts with a turn of a key. It's got a dial dashboard, as you can see. I mean, it's very much like driving an internal combustion engine, so that when you step into this car, there's nothing to figure out.
Now, what prompted you to want an electric car?
I drive a lot for my job every day, and I was paying, no lie, between $400 and $450 a month on gasoline, and I just said, you know what, enough is enough. This is ridiculous. And my wife and I promised ourselves that our next car was going to be an electric car. So the car I was driving, I bought it brand new. I'd had it for 21 years. It was becoming unsound, and it was time to get a new car.
Is this your commuter car now?
This is my commuter car. I drive this car every day.
And you plug it in at night?
That's correct. I drive it into my garage, plug it in just like my cell phone.
And do you ever have to plug it in during the day? And if so, do you look for places, or is that a problem?
Well, thanks to the internet, I look up electric vehicle charging stations. For example, one time we were going to go to Anacortes, and that's 85 miles away, and we knew that was going to be a challenge. And so we looked up where the charging stations were in Anacortes. There happened to be one right next to the event we were going to. So I drove this car 85 miles on freeway speeds with two extra passengers and luggage. And when I got there, I still had 25% left on the battery. So I whipped out a calculator and I figured that was 121 miles of range right there. We plugged it into the charging station. We went to our event. By the time our event was over, we had enough juice to go home again.
Now, that is the perfect description of how you're going to be thinking about an electric car that you can charge. In that, if you're, you know, on the edge of your range, you have to give it some time to charge. Is that in any way an inconvenience for you?
No, because I planned my life around it. I said I was going to this event. I knew I was going to be at this event for several hours. And I said, as long as the car is parked, it might as well be plugged in.
And how come, Kevin, you went for a Coda, a new company, rather than, you know, one of the established companies?
I still ask myself that, because I'm not a risk taker. I'm not a guy who steps out over the cliff like that. It was a huge leap of faith to buy this car, but I saw this at the Seattle Auto Show. I loved it. I asked them if I could take a test drive. They said, well, you're going to have to go to California to do that. I said, that's fine. I went to Santa Clara, my old stomping grounds when I was a teenager. There was a Coda dealership there. We drove it around. And one of the things they don't tell you, I mean, they tell you about the ecological advantages and how it doesn't use gasoline and so that. What they don't tell you is how much fun these things are to drive. They are a blast to drive. By the time we brought it back, we said, we'll take it. So we put our money down. They put the order into the factory, and about a week later, they put it on a truck and drove it up to my house.
Now, what makes this car more fun to drive than if you were driving a little sporty internal combustion engine car?
I think it's got everything that an internal combustion engine car has. I mean, it's got acceleration, it's got handling, it's got a 51-49 balance between the front and the rear axles, so the weight's really nicely distributed. The battery is under the floor between the wheels, so the center of gravity is really low. This corner's like a dream, and it's just a great car to drive.
Do you have any illusions that it's still going to take a long time for more people to accept the idea of buying an electric car?
One of the things I tell people, I say, is this the perfect car? No, absolutely not. Is this the perfect car for me and my driving needs and what I need it to do? Absolutely. This is my commuter vehicle. I got a 60-mile round trip, and when I come home, the battery is at about half, so 120, 125 miles, that's pretty accurate. It's got plenty of extra miles for all the errands I need to do, and it does everything I need to do.
And like all these electric cars, pretty darn quiet.
Yes, I love how quiet it is. Now, some of my friends have said, yeah, but you can't drive it to Portland. And what do you do if you need to go to Portland? And I said, I do what any sane, rational adult does when I need to go to Portland. Take the train. You know, get a glass of wine, read a book. I mean, who drives to Portland? And there was a guy who told me, he says, well, I drive to Portland 6 days a week. I said, well, okay, then you shouldn't have an electric car. But there's a Leaf. Hi. Another electric car.
Kevin Bowes. He drives a 2012 Kota sedan, the first in Washington State, production number 0024. Kota is a privately held Los Angeles-based company that designs, manufactures, and sells all-electric vehicles. They've raised at least $300 million from global investors. The company is working with Chinese firms on battery development and new car models. With Great Wall Motors of China, Kota plans on producing their first all-electric vehicle for the global market in 2014. This is Weekday.
Will humans ever stop fighting wars once and for all?
If you go out and ask a bunch of random people that question, you're going to get...
No.
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 I just think that it's too ingrained in our human nature.
Yeah.
Is there such a thing as human nature, like that's forever and ever?
What can we do about it? Are we stuck or...
Or can we change who we are?
Yeah.
That's next time on Radiolab.
And that comes your way Friday night at 7 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 9:15. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medicine Hernia Center at Northwest Hospital, established to serve the entire region, featuring surgical specialists dedicated to treating patients with all types of hernia conditions. More information online at uwmedicine.org/hernia.
We have cloudy skies, a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 54 degrees in the University District. We're expecting a high today of 55. The forecast calls for partly sunny skies later with a chance of rain. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of rain, the low in the mid-40s, partly sunny tomorrow, the high in the mid-50s.
Now we're going to take up and talk about some words we cannot say on the in the public sphere, on the public airwaves. So we will allude to them. But if you are at all offended even by the idea of these words, you are now forewarned. Because swear words, they're all around us. They're not simply the raw emotional response, not an outburst. They have meanings. We use them for specific times, in specific ways, for specific actions or people. They are even conjugated, right? So today we're going to talk about one word. The ascent of the A-wordism, the first 60 years. That's Jeffrey Nunberg's new book. Nunberg is a linguist, a professor at the UC Berkeley School of Information. You've also heard him for a long time as offering language commentaries on NPR's Fresh Air. He's also written in the New York Times and other books as well. Jeffrey Nunberg, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
So the A-word. The A-wordism, or A-bomb. I suppose I can use A-bomb.
Right.
We don't say those.
It's a crude, coarse word, and it ought to be. It has to be because we need something like that to yell when our neighbor starts the leaf blower at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. And I don't have any problem saying A-word or A-bomb or talking around it. I think we want to keep it coarse. But that said... It isn't. That doesn't mean we oughtn't to think about this word. It's an important concept in our everyday moral lives. It's the word that comes to mind when that leaf blower starts, or when we see somebody being a real jerk. We don't think incivility. We think the A word. And for that reason, I think it's very important to look at words like that.
Why do you bring up incivility? This is a word that people toss around all the time now, especially when they talk about the coarsening of our public sphere.
Yeah, it's this word. It's a word that lives its life on op-ed pages. It's a word that stands up on its hind legs. It's not a word about which people can speak honestly, I think, precisely because it is the kind of word that conjures up these discourses about the coarsening of the public sphere and so on. Whereas the A word, precisely because it's a word that we don't pay any attention to. It's a vulgar word. It's one we're even loath to say in public context. That's a word that reflects our real attitudes. I tell a story in the book about a friend of mine, a Texan, finds himself in New York on 9/11, desperate to get out, get home to his family, goes to the Hertz rental place on the West Side, hundreds of people in there all yelling, the clerks trying to deal with it as they try to get cars to get out of the city. And a little guy comes in and walks to the front of the room and pulls out his wallet and says, "Excuse me, can you tell me where the gold card line is?" And it struck me that every person in that room was thinking the same three-word sentence. And the third word was not incivility. It was the A word. So when you want to understand how we think about these things, you want to look at the language we use to describe them.
What is the concept that we are all experiencing? What is the feeling we are all experiencing when that happens?
Well, it seems to me that above all, the A word expresses a kind of moral obtuseness, a culpable refusal to acknowledge the difference between what we are, what our status is, and who we are as people. And so it's a question of dealing with people inauthentically. Now, that guy in the Hertz rental place wasn't malign, wasn't nasty, wasn't rude. I mean, he was rude, but he wasn't a nasty person. He was just almost deliberately unconscious of what was going on, and imagined that his possession of this piece of plastic entitled him to trump the needs of these people on this very extraordinary occasion. So I think that's the basic idea behind the word. And it's a new word. It's a word that entered our moral lives. Oh, it's first coined during the Second World War, but it really becomes part of our everyday language around 1970. So it's quite recent in that sense.
I want to come back to its origin, but you say the A word embodies the obligations we share in everyday life.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you ask yourself, and it's not a vague word in that sense, or no vaguer than other moral terms. You can merit that label for cheating on your wife, but say not for cheating on your income tax. You can merit it for cutting me off in the left turn lane, but not for texting while you drive, for stealing ideas from coworkers, but maybe not for plagiarizing from a published book. Not that those other things aren't reprehensible, but they don't qualify you for the A word. It's a very specific notion. And it's moreover one that we use only for people in our immediate, people who are familiar to us. You wouldn't use it of Osama bin Laden, for example, or Joseph Stalin. Horrible people, but too remote, too exotic to merit the A word.
Don't I'm going to dabble in a little politics here, but don't both campaigns in some way want to taint the other guy with that notion?
Yeah, there's a strategy in modern politics that I think is genuinely new. One reason I wanted to write the book is because everybody was talking about the incivility of modern political life. And there was this sort of paradox because historians are saying, look, really what people are saying now is no more vituperative or uncivil than what they were saying about during the McCarthy years or about FDR, or about Lincoln or Jackson or Jefferson. And that's true. But modern political life has a specific tone that's tied to the A word. The idea is if you can make the other party, the other side, into people who merit the A word, people who are self-important, obtuse, pretentious, out of touch, then you're entitled to be an A word back at them. And I think that's what the A word encompasses. To call somebody by the A word, after all, is to swear at them. And the idea here is that if they're a jerk, you have a right to be a jerk in response. And that's a principle that, we'll say a lot of talk radio and talk television is based on that principle. We get to be jerks and enjoy being jerks because they're jerks.
Yeah, you talk about the matter-antimatter aspect of this word, right. Jeffrey Nunberg.
Right. Antimatter is, you know, sort of stuff like matter that reacts violently in response to it. I think of it as the Dirty Harry principle. And in fact, Dirty Harry, those movies appear about the time the A word is becoming part of the American vernacular. And the idea is that the people surrounding Dirty Harry are all such A words, whether his superiors or the people in the media, the police psychologist, the sociopaths he's after, that he has a right to do really terrible things to them in response, things that John Wayne would never do, sticking somebody's head in a toilet and flushing it and so on. And that's the principle that's at stake in this word, that if you're an A-word, I get to be an A-word back at you. And I think that's the characteristic tone that we discern as being incivility in modern political life.
It's interesting, though, but that permission only, it seems like you were writing that permission only goes so far. Is that right? The permission to be that way back.
It's important. It's not as if that's wrong. I mean, there are times when treating people as rudely or speaking of them in this way is not only permitted but almost obligatory. A friend calls you. She tells you her husband. She's just discovered her husband's having an affair with a babysitter. You are morally obliged to say what an A-word, not merely permitted, but obliged by way of indicating the degree of your indignation and signaling your solidarity with her and inviting her to substitute an appropriate rage for her feelings of hurt or being wounded. So the word plays this very important role in our moral life, and that's appropriate. It's when it bubbles up, percolates up into public life that it becomes problematic. When somebody says to a president during an address, "You lie," and his supporters send contributions on the grounds that the A word had it coming, that's where this principle's misapplied, I think.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist. He's a professor at UC Berkeley School of Information. You've heard him on Fresh Air. His previous books include Talking Right and Going Nuclear. Lives in San Francisco. Ascent of the A-Word, A-Wordism, and the First 60 Years. You use another word there instead, but I'm not using that either because I don't want a course in the public debate. But, all right, so before the rise of this word, somebody found out somebody else was having an affair. Would I have a different moral response 100 years ago or 200 years ago?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you would be as indignant as you would be today, given all the changes in private life. But you describe it differently. You'd say, what a cad or what a bounder. Maybe in the 1920s or 30s, you'd say, what a heel. And those words really come at the offense in a different way. To speak of somebody as a cad is to suggest that he's not a gentleman. He falls short of being a gentleman. It looks at the world from the top down. We're gentlemen looking at the ruck of people who fail to come up to our standards. When you use the A word, which women begin to use of men in this sense around 1971, it starts with a feminist and then all women take it up. When you use that word, you're not speaking from the top down. You're speaking from the bottom up, so to speak. You're speaking, look, we're regular guys together. And we're looking at this person who's gotten above himself, who's given himself privileges that we don't feel he deserves. And the he there, because people who merit this word very usually are men.
What were swear words of another era that were from the bottom up or from equals, or were there none?
Well, no, there were swear words. There have always been swear words, and swearing has always been intricately connected to class in this sense. In the 19th century, they used technically profanities being words like damn and hell and so on that one used. When you see a show like Deadwood, they're using language when they use the F word and so on and so forth that nobody used back then. They said damn and hell and so on. This other language comes in at the beginning of the 20th century, it comes to full flower during World War II. But it isn't just the language. It's that for the first time in the history of English and other languages as well, we take these words that are vulgar or obscene because of their connection to the body or sex or things like that, and we turn them into new words that are descriptions for social behavior that really doesn't have much to do with any of those things. When you call somebody, describe somebody with the A word, say Donald Trump, you're not suggesting that anything about his sex life or his personal habits. You're not saying anything about him that you couldn't say on the op-ed page of the New York Times, provided you put it in more decorous language. So these new words, the A word, the BS word, all the combinations with the F word, F'd up and F over and so on, those are all new words formed from these old obscene words. And as I say, English has never done anything like this before.
You do say that there are equivalents to the A word in other, I guess you were mostly talking about Romance languages, right? German and Spanish, I think. Is that right?
Right. I don't know if I'd call German a Romance language.
Yeah, right, yeah.
The Germans use, I suppose I can say the words on American radio, even though and certainly you can say them on their radio because they're not as uptight about it as we are. Germans use Arschloch, which is the same as the A word. The Italians use stronzo, which is turd. The Mexican Spanish, they often say pendejo, which is a pubic hair. It's always something low and in the popular view foul and unseemly and that creates this impression that these people are contemptible And that's one of the things the A word signals. They're also dirty words in the technical sense. And it's important, as I say, that they be dirty words, because when you use a dirty word, what you're signaling is that your emotions are so strong that they've overcome these basic inhibitions, or that the other person is so contemptible that he isn't worthy of the respect we normally show when we avoid these words. So the words have to be dirty to accomplish this effect.
But the way they're so prevalent in our culture today, don't they lose that power?
You know, the interesting thing is, no. There are words, certainly, that once were quite vulgar and that now aren't. You know, adolescents now say, oh, that sucks, and they have no idea that anybody ever would have been disturbed by that. But the crappy is the same kind of word. But these words remain vulgar. They're perhaps less shocking when uttered in public context than they once were. But it isn't as if the force of using the A word to somebody is diminished by the fact of its common use. In fact, the interesting thing about these words is that we have to keep them vulgar in their literal senses so that they will have the same force when they're used in these figurative senses. There are people who say, oh, the F word, if we can only rid ourselves of our bourgeois hang-ups, we wouldn't find this upsetting at all. But if we did rid ourselves of our vulgar hang-ups and the F-word was no longer upsetting, we couldn't use it when we want to tell somebody off.
Well, you write in this book also about the coarsening of the discussions I guess we're back to the matter-antimatter aspect of the power of these words. But if they don't lose their power by overuse, what do they become in the public sphere go ahead.
No, I think they do. I mean, I think they become representative of a certain tone in the public sphere, whether or not we use the words or not. I'm not primarily concerned with this word or with words like it, but concerned with the word as a signal of changes in our moral attitudes and our attitudes about how we ought to behave with each other, toward each other, particularly in public life. And I think this kind of exchange, the sort of exchange that we describe as incivility, is very specific to the modern world. Look, the critics of Roosevelt, Westbrook Pegler, said terrible things and were anti-Semites and so forth, were awful people, for more so arguably than somebody like Ann Coulter. But Westbrook Pegler wouldn't have understood what in the world Ann Coulter was thinking about when she criticized, say, the 9/11 widows for enjoying their husbands' deaths, because it seems so gratuitous. And in fact, it is gratuitous. The point is to say something so outrageous that you'll make the other side completely indignant and get to enjoy the prospect of their indignation, of being naughty at their expense. And as I say, this is the pleasure we take in being a jerk to a jerk, and it's characteristic of our discourse and historically unprecedented.
So you don't need the use of the A word to engage in that sort of tweaking of one another. Fox News can do it, or MSNBC can do it without having to resort to swearing.
Right. As I say, the Dirty Harry movies do offer a kind of moral picture that's different from anything you'd see in a John Wayne movie. Now, the word does appear in the Dirty Harry movies, but that isn't the crucial point. The point is that that's a moral code, a moral logic, so to speak, that's signaled by the A word, whether or not the word is actually used.
What's the history of it? What's the history of the A word? Where does it start?
Well, it begins in the mouths of GIs during World War II. It's a way of reproaching a vainglorious or overbearing officer. The first military leader to be tagged with the word by both his men and his superiors was George Patton, which, if you know the real story of Patton, is not surprising. The movie Patton makes him a little less of an A-word than he was, in fact.
Only a little.
Norman Mailer uses it, the first literary use in The Naked and the Dead, his war novel published in 1948, and the GIs bring it home. But it doesn't really become part of the everyday American vernacular, as I said, until around 1970. That's when you start to see it in not just Dirty Harry movies, but Woody Allen movies and Neil Simon plays. People start to use the word middle-class people in everyday life. That's when the feminists take it up and make it a reproach for men who behave insensitively or crudely toward women. The men who used to be heels now become A-words. It's when movements like EST and the self-discovery movements take the word up. It's when it enters political life and becomes part of the new politics of class. In fact, writing the book, one of the interesting things for me was that it turned out, and I hadn't anticipated that to tell the story of this word is to tell a lot of the social history of the last 40 or 50 years.
Really? Is that right?
Well, yeah. It's feminism, for example, adopts a new word for these men that suggests a new idea about what it is that men owe women, not just a question of treating them decently, but of being aware, of being sensitive. Because to be the A word, as I say, is to be obtuse. It's a psychological condition. If you think of a heel from the 30s movies, the kind of characters played by Zachary Scott or Dan Duryea, he's a heel. But you have no idea what he's thinking, and you don't care what he's thinking. It's what he does that makes him a heel. When somebody becomes an A word, a word that we often modify with pathetic, all of a sudden, it's not simply a question of what he does, but his failure, his obtuseness about what other people are feeling, his lack of empathy. And that's a shift in attitude that runs very deeply in our moral life.
Now, you mentioned Woody Allen. You pull out some examples of Woody Allen, I guess, as by way of showing examples of how this concept was starting to be used in public life. And the famous one is the one from Annie Hall. Is that a good example?
Yeah, Woody Allen is another kind of Dirty Harry. There's always a setup in the Woody Allen movies, some pretentious, self-important, out-of-touch West Side intellectuals that he can send up and be really a jerk to because they have it coming. It's a theme that runs all the way up to Midnight in Paris. The same character appears, and the Woody Allen character, played by another actor, can get after him in the same way. It's a theme that you see in movies like Animal House. John Belushi gets to be a real jerk, spitting food in the face of these fraternity guys and sorority girls because they're jerks, because they merit the A-word. So it's a principle you see running through American popular culture beginning again around 1970 in its modern form.
Well, describe the evolution of the moral concepts, because you talk about the rise of incivility and civility as the A-word also starts to rise. But before that, we had, you write about Holden Caulfield and this concern over phonies. Was that, is this the evolutionary process? Is he an earlier iteration?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Every age has one, maybe two words that represent its social anxieties that it focuses on. In the 19th century, the age of Trollope or Meredith, it was the cad or the bounder. In the post-war years, as you mentioned in Holden Caulfield or in Allen Ginsberg, it was the phony, somebody whose representation of himself was different from who he really was. By 1970, it becomes the A-word. And what's extraordinary is how many of these figures are important in our consciousness. I went to look at the characters that Barbara Walters lists in her lists of most fascinating people. And year after year, anywhere between 4 and 6 of them are people who unquestionably qualify for the A-word. Last year it was, Donald Trump, Simon Cowell, Herman Cain, the Kardashians, Derek Jeter, you could go either way on him, and then a few characters like Pippa Middleton and so on who weren't particularly meriting this tone. But year after year, it's Tiger Woods, it's Donald Trump again and again, it's LeBron James, it's Tom Cruise. These are all people who merit that label, and they hold a fascination for us that's really characteristic of the modern age. Donald Trump would be known vaguely as a rich guy if he had lived 30 or 40 years ago. His ability to parlay his personality into this media celebrity is something very much particular to our age.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist, professor at the University of California at Berkeley School of Information. Ascent of the A-Word, A-Wordism, the First 60 Years is his book. We'll take a break, and then 5 more minutes with you, Jeffrey Nunberg. I want to ask you about where this takes us today and what you see trending in the future. This is Weekday on KUOW.
Good morning. It's 9:39. I'm Andy Hurst. Serious poker players believe it's a game of skill, but federal law classified poker as a game of chance. This week, a federal district court ruled in favor of the players. We'll hear more about the case and its implications for gambling in this country. That comes your way this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from Graham and Dunn, a full-service law firm focused on helping Northwest businesses tackle challenges faced on the path to success. Online at grahamdunn.com, located on Pier 70. Business law from a different point of view.
Polio was once one of the most feared diseases in America. In 1955, science offered hope.
A major medical hurdle was crossed with the discovery by Dr. Jonas Salk of the anti-polio vaccine.
Now polio is on the verge of being eradicated from the planet. A look back at the decades-long fight against polio. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6. Then tune in for the second presidential debate live tonight at 6 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Academy, starting in 6th grade and preparing students for such college destinations as last year's seniors, which includes Columbia, Harvey Mudd, and Georgetown. Open house information at seattleacademy.org.
We have cloudy skies, a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 54 degrees in the University District. We're working towards a high today of 55. Forecast says partly sunny later with a chance of showers. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of showers, the low in the mid-40s, partly sunny tomorrow, the high in the mid-50s.
In Ascent of the A-Word, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers a word that has divided, offended, and empowered us for the last 60 years, us, the users of it. What is its essence? That's what we're talking about with Jeffrey Nunberg, the linguist professor at the University of California at Berkeley. I've heard him on Fresh Air for many years. Jeffrey Nunberg, you mentioned Donald Trump, and I want to ask you about where you see this, the embrace of this concept. And you say there are three A words for the age, and you start with Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs, is he an A word?
Yeah, I mean, I think Jobs represents a certain type of person who merits this label. He certainly was in his behavior to other people, and Isaacson's biography makes this clear. The book would not have sold more than a couple hundred copies if he hadn't been doing terrible. I know somebody who quit his job at Apple just because he says he got tired of wiping Jobs' spittle off his glasses. He was also a marketing genius and a design genius. And that connection is one that makes him a particularly interesting case. It happens, as I say, that not just with celebrities of different sorts, but the business leaders and CEOs that we are most interested in very often also have this character, whether it's Jobs or Ellison or Chainsaw Al Dunlop and so on. Now, they're also the Warren Buffetts of the world. But again, there's this idea that people have or sometimes like to have that you have to be something of an A-word to succeed in business. And there are business school management people who say this is true. There are other people who say that's silly. There are a lot of ways to do it. And while it helps to be able to be tough, you don't really have to do this. But that, again, is a question that people ask now in a way that they weren't asking it 20 or 30 years ago.
How do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, people always regarded businessmen as tough and so on. But to use a word like the A-word to suggest that one has to be a bit of a jerk, a bit of an A-word to succeed, is to suggest the amorality of management life. It was not a picture that you had in the corporate world of the 1950s or 1960s. But it suggests a very different attitude about these things, where CEOs now are something like rock stars and can get away with being A-words for the same reason the guys from Metallica can. They do it because they can. And that, again, is fascinating to us.
But there's a level of admiration, isn't there, for Steve Jobs, even in that he is treating people that way?
Yeah, no, I think Bob Sutton, who's a management scholar at the Stanford Business School, who wrote a book called The No A-Word Rule about this and is a terrific on this subject,
He made the point that, you know, people have very different ideas about Jobs being an A word and the connection to his management skills. He says it never tells you a lot about Jobs, but it tells you a whole lot about the people who are coming up with the theories. I think he's a particularly interesting case because the fact is that you can't just dismiss people as A words. And the reason, in fact, that I use the word A wordism in my subtitle is because I think it's important to realize that these aren't just another race of people or another type of person like blondes or people with blue eyes or left-handed people. It's a condition we're all subject to. We're all liable to. You get off the phone with United Airlines or Comcast or whatever, and you realize, boy, I was a real A-word. In our relationships, it's hard not to be that way sometimes. And I think if you realize that, then your view of these things we're talking about, like incivility, changes. All of a sudden, it isn't this condition out there that's induced by the media or the breakdown of the family or permissive parenting or whatever. It's something that grows inherently out of our moral principles. As I say, the idea that, you know, somebody who's an A-word, to somebody who's an A-word, you can behave like somebody who's an A-word. You can be a jerk to a jerk. And that's what the problem is with our public life.
Right. It's that matter antimatter thing. We get tainted.
Yeah.
And you do argue that there are other responses, more morally centered responses. What would you say to those responses?
Right. I think there's a difference between public life and private life. I think you can be a jerk to somebody who's being a jerk. It's a liberating principle. And when you're on the highway or somebody does something or your friend's husband who's having an affair with a babysitter, you can behave like a jerk to that person. It's different in public life. And the erosion of that boundary, the blurring of that boundary, which is aided by the technology, which makes the distinction between public and private much more problematic than it was 30 or 40 years ago, means that we're behaving toward people in public life the way we would if they cut us off on the highway. And that's where you get in trouble. And as I say, the Internet has a certain amount to do with this.
You think? Why?
Well, because it's so easy? You know, I don't think there are more A-words in the world than there used to be. I mean, you read Trollope and Dickens and their cads and bounders and scoundrels are all over the place. The amount of human incivility remains pretty much a constant over time. We do have many more opportunities for acting this out, particularly in these anonymous contexts. So you go on the Internet, you read the blogs, you read the comments on news stories, and people just, if you feel like being a jerk at 3 a.m, you can get up and go on some blog and be a troll to people of the opposite political persuasion. And I think that's very much characteristic of what's wrong with our political discourse, that we take a kind of almost a pleasure in it. It's a world in which political contumely and vituperation can become the model for a 24/7 business plan. And that's really, again, unprecedented in our public life.
The concept gives us the excuse to act that way. It gives us the
yeah,
the,
yeah,
not
and,
just
and
the
it's
excuse.
Pleasant. It's, we enjoy watching Dirty Harry do these things to these people because they have it coming.
But when somebody
or McNulty in The Wire or in The Shield or Woody Allen taking on these people or John Belushi, it's very pleasant to watch this. Or watching a radio host on the right or the left say terrible things to these awful people on the other side. That pleasure, which is a genuine pleasure, is the problem in a sense. That's what makes this problematic. That's what makes us all complicit in the condition of modern public discourse.
Somebody cuts you off, you can quietly or even loudly curse at them, but taking the next step of cutting them off themselves, cutting them off as well, that's a step beyond cursing. Isn't that what the cursing and the lax atmosphere allows us to get towards, reacting in public violently, angrily?
Yeah, no, I think there's a legitimation of rage that accompanies this. And one reason why the ease, the greater ease with which people use swear words, and that again begins around 1970 is the moment at which it really shifts. Women begin to swear, and so on. Is it allows us this outlet for these feelings rather than repressing them. But you're quite right. It also legitimates a kind of rage that can be, again, very problematic.
So you wrote this book in part that with knowledge comes understanding. What's my understanding? What's my takeaway of the A
word.
Well,
the takeaway, I think, is, you know, we've met the A words and they are us. Right? I mean, that this is a condition that's endemic in modern life. I mean, look, I you know, another reason I wrote the book is because, you know, you can't write about this topic without, you know, looking inward. As the poet Philip Sidney said, "Fool said my muse to me, look in your heart and write." And I looked in my heart and I wanted to write a book about the A word. Now, you can make of that what you will. But I think there is a kind of reflection that comes of thinking about any kind of moral language, whether it's the high-blown language of incivility or the vulgar language that we actually use in everyday life. To think about the language, to think about the concept, is to become self-aware. And the problem of the A-word, of people who merit that label, is precisely that they're not self-aware. So it's a way of correcting one's own A-wordism, so to speak.
Jeffrey Nunberg, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me.
I appreciate it. Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist, a professor. His book, Ascent of the A-Word, A-Wordism, the First 60 Years. This is Weekday. Michael Fagan, how's the weather?
Well, I thought you were going to play the sound of the week. You know, there's that famous song, Raindrops Keep Falling. Oh,
that would be nice.
I know my skier friends are quite happy. There's snowflakes falling at 5,000 feet this morning.
So is there?
A dusting of snow at Paradise at Mount Rainier and at Stevens Pass above 5,000 feet. Now, the hike that we have for this week is Sawyer Mountain, just west of Stevens Pass. And it's does top out at 5,500 feet, so you might have a dusting of snow up there, but at this point we're not expecting any issues as far as getting up on the hike. It's a pretty short hike, 3 miles one way, 1,200-foot gain. And if the weather cooperates, which the best cooperation will be this Wednesday and Thursday if you're looking for views, you do get a view of Mount Daniel, Mount Hidman, Mount Rainier, and Mount Glacier, and that's a heck of a view. And even if the views aren't there, fall colors should still be hanging on. We were there two weeks ago, and it was just starting to be at its peak. And you might want to make a little note of this hike. It's a good winter venture, too. You could snowshoe or ski there in December and January. And speaking of snow, we put a link on my blog as far as what the early winter outlook is, and you can check that out on my blog. And, again, this hike is good to get in before it gets buried by snow, and that could be in 2 or 3 weeks. And, again, over the next week, we're just expecting a dusting of snow, and you might want to bring those yak tracks to get some good traction in case there is some rain or light dusting of snow.
Oh, you think there might be enough in the forecast to merit the yak tracks?
Yeah, it's getting to that point, you know, especially if you're hitting the trail early in the morning or late. It can get icy, and especially the forecast models are suggesting by next Sunday and Monday, the highs in the mountains only in the upper 30s. So winter's right around the corner.
Now, this Sawyer Mountain, this turning right onto the Foss River Road. Foss River Road, as you say, once the snows come, it doesn't get plowed at all, does it?
No, it's an interesting area in that some of the snowmobilers use it, so the pack can be hard, but it's definitely a good one to do midweek, and it's not plowed. And the road conditions right now, I was surprised at how good a conditions the road was in. It's so a lot of passenger vehicles on it. And I did want to mention this is Green Trails Map 175 and 176, and you need your forest pass. And again, on the yak tracks, it's just good to start putting that in your pack now for safekeeping.
Yak tracks are those little sort of just the tiny crampons, right?
Right. It's like a coil you put on the bottom of your boot, and it works good. And there's some other products. You can go to your favorite sporting goods supply place, and it's good to put in there. So, you know, we'll be, you know, it's still early yet for skiing and snowshoeing, but that's a good in-between piece of equipment.
So, Michael Fagan, just one thing about that. El Niño, La Niña, or La Nada, which I'd never heard before, technically known as the neutral. What are people saying right now in weather circles about this, what looks like a weak El Niño or the La Nada?
Well, about Several months ago, the Climate Prediction Center, a part of the NOAA U.S. government, was looking at El Nino, which is warm sea surface temperatures off the coast of Peru. And usually when we have El Nino, the typical pattern is warm and dry winter for us, and the skiers get rather down in the dumps with that. Now, all of a sudden, and Nick Bond confers with this, is saying it's looking like more of a very, very weak El Nino, or just a neutral condition, or what us in the business call La Nada, neutral conditions. And when we have a normal winter, it's just average snow conditions, so skiers can be happy with that. And it's hard to say, you know, what we get in terms of snow in the city. That's a whole other can of worms. But in the mountains, we're looking at average snow conditions, at least at this point in time.
Michael Fagan specializes in mountain weather forecasts in the western U.S. from the Washington Cascades to the Sierras. He also forecasts for major mountains like Denali, Mount Everest, and K2. People are climbing, and he also joins us every Tuesday to talk about some hikes and the weather. Also author of Best Rain Shadow, Hikes in Western Washington. I forgot about that, Michael. I'm going to keep on reminding myself that you wrote that book.
Yeah, that's what got me started in this business. After I went to a backpack trip in the rainforest, and it rained. What a surprise. That's what happens when someone from Chicago moves here and doesn't look at the details. But not anymore.
Not anymore. Now you know. All right, sir. I appreciate you talking to us.
You bet. Bye.
Bye-bye. We'll talk to Michael Fagan again next Tuesday. Get another forecast and another hike.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of salsa dancing in Benaroya Hall lobby after the Northwest Sinfonietta's performance of The Cubans Are Coming. Weekday listener Nancy videotaped the festivities, sent it to us. As the music ends, a woman in red is dipped low by her dance partner twice. Nearby, another couple energetically dances, even though the woman is still holding onto her big purse. You can see the video Nancy sent on our Facebook page. Search for Weekday on KUOW. Video is a great way to capture the sounds that are going on around you if you don't have any other recording device, because we want to hear what the day sounds like to you, and the night, and the late night. The unexpected dances, the improvised moments, those unique sounds that happen in your day to make your day a little more interesting. Send us a sound and send us the story behind that sound. Record 30 seconds and send it to us with sound of the day in the subject line. Just something to keep you dancing, yes? We'd like to hear from you. So I got a couple of letters. One in a response to that conversation. Someone who cuts me off about the A word. Someone who cuts me off is not necessarily an A word. But the guy who deliberately speeds up when he sees my signal to change lanes, he is an A-word. And also, earlier we took a drive in a Coda. Listening to your guest who discussed mapping out a charging station before going to Anacortes, I was thinking about the Chevy Volt. Working in downtown Seattle, I would never use gasoline 90% of the time, but could still go to Anacortes or Portland in my car without worrying about where charging stations are. This is from Steve. Why invest in charging stations when we could have hybrids like the Volt? I don't know. Does that give us what we want if we invest in hybrids rather than the Volt? What is it that society wants? They want a plug-in hybrid. They talk about so that they can not have to be reliant on any other form of energy. But yeah, then you have to rely on having the charging station. I've driven in, let's see, the Leaf, the Mitsubishi, the Volt, the Coda. I think I'm forgetting one as well. besides the Prius. Oh, the Tesla, of course, the Tesla. They've all been very interesting cars, these electric cars. I don't know if I have a favorite, but I will say this. Tesla, it's a pretty cool car, whether it's a hybrid or electric or, I guess, gasoline. But I would say the Mitsubishi and the Leaf, they're very nice. If you have a car you want, an electric car, it's not on that list, some new car, maybe one you've made, let us know. Stay around. We're going to look at the gardening world. We're going to look at daredevils, and we're going to look at these debates coming up.
Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
Support for KUOW comes from area schools affiliated with the Pacific Northwest Association of Independent Schools. More information about open houses, financial aid, and the range of education choices, such as Open Window School.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.